volunteers. This is what WPFW sounds like with volunteers. Help WPFW avoid the sound of static and continue the mission of building a better world, one broadcast at a time, by becoming a phone volunteer today. Information and registration at 202-588-0999, extension 1008, or via email at volunteers@wpfw.org. Just say you want to volunteer and leave your name, phone number, and email address. It's that easy. Again, that's 202-588-0999, extension 1008, or volunteers@wpfw.org. Phone volunteering is a critical part of supporting WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Marilyn Mobley. Marilyn Mobley is the author of Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging, published by Temple University Press. She's also a founding member of the Toni Morrison Society. How are you doing today, Marilyn?
I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Ethelbert.
I want to say congratulations to you.
I know you just got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Period Flower Company.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, you know, around our country today, Marilyn, we often see the work of Toni Morrison being placed on the list of banned books. Why should we read Toni Morrison, and what does her work teach us?
I appreciate that question because I believe Toni Morrison always had a prophetic voice and a prophetic vision. And it seemed to me she's part of the history. She tells the history through art, through fiction, that we really need to know. And I believe she was able to articulate the nuances of that history in ways that other people have not. And so it's unfortunate that people believe banning books gets you something. Banning books makes you less educated, or as Carter G. Woodson would say, makes you miseducated. And I believe having taught at different kinds of institutions, I've worked at both HBCUs and at predominantly white institutions. And what I find is students of all backgrounds want to know the history. Students, as a rule, do not appreciate books being banned. And I don't know about other people, but the way I was, if you told me I couldn't read something, that's really when I wanted to read it. And so I think the ways in which Toni Morrison's writing helps fill in gaps of history, both intellectually, emotionally, and even spiritually, her work is important. She was an advocate for not banning books. And she often would talk about how people who ban books don't know you just increase the sales of the authors. We heard her speak at Princeton, and she was telling us how there was a prison in Texas that had banned Paradise. And she thought it was amusing because she said, wow, my book must really be powerful if they're banning it from prisoners reading it. And they even had gone to the extent of marking out the passages that they could not read. But she thought it was extra amusing that they had not mentioned the first line of Paradise, which is they shoot the white girl first.
Right.
So she was just interested in how the very act of banning books showed how powerful language is, shows how powerful words are. And I've always been interested in the kind of history you learn when you read Toni Morrison that is not even always in a history book, but it's the layers, what she calls literary archaeology. She goes down into the layers of experience. And many of us want to know, you know, we want to get to those layers another way, in the way only art can, I think, only the way literature can. So I believe it's important to teach her work because it's a nice supplement to what people have learned in their history books about enslavement, about American history, about Jim Crow, about the Great Migration. You know, all of her work takes us through different historical periods in American history.
Well, let me ask you this question. You know, I just outlined the different things that she does, and you're talking about teaching Toni Morrison. Do you consider Toni Morrison a difficult writer to understand?
Okay, I'll go ahead and admit it. Yes.
Okay.
I know that she can be difficult. And I like your question because in a way, that's what prompted me to write the book. As I'm doing this book tour, I talk about lessons learned from rereading Toni Morrison. And in a sense, I wrote the book to encourage people to reread her or to try again. I found it so fascinating that she wrote in a few essays. She had an interview even with our late friend Claudia Tate, who used to teach at Howard.
Right.
And she talked about writing, Toni Morrison talked about writing to leave spaces for the reader to get into the text. So I began to find this really ironic because as I would teach her, as I would go to different conferences or book clubs, meet with book clubs, people would say, oh, I don't read Toni Morrison anymore. She's too hard.
Well, let me ask you this question, because I associate you with the classroom, but I also associate you with university administration.
Thank you.
So I was wondering, sometimes when you get into administration, you get detached from the classroom. So was it different going back to the classroom and teaching Toni Morrison?
Oh, what a wonderful question. I never left the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I have always wanted people to know that because, you know, when I was at George Mason University and went from being director, I was the founding director of African American Studies at George Mason. And the provost hired me to be his associate provost for educational programs. And that's the first time I heard the expression, oh, so you're going to the dark side. And I thought, what in the world? So initially I thought it was a racial slur and they said, Meryl, it's not a racial slur. So anyway, I made a practice then. And when I became provost at Bennett, I did it as well there. And then when I was chief diversity officer at Case Western, which is where I earned my PhD, I told the president, no, I want to remain in the classroom. So I always taught at least one class a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult to teach every semester, but I tried to teach one semester. And every course I taught, I included Toni Morrison.
Okay, well, let's look at that.
Because that was my commitment to never really leave her, really leave teaching, my first love.
Okay, but you know, when you're putting together a course outline, syllabus,
mm-hmm.
you have to make a selection. So which Toni Morrison book were you teaching?
It depends on the course. When I taught...
Okay, let me ask the question the other way. Which Toni Morrison books did you not teach?
Oh. Well, I didn't teach the last one, of course. I hadn't gotten to that one. I didn't teach Love.
What about jazz? Did you taught jazz?
I definitely taught jazz. So I taught a course on the Harlem Renaissance.
Okay.
So I taught jazz. I taught a course... on slavery and the literary imagination. So I taught Beloved there. I taught a course on Black women writers. So I included her, I include The Bluest Eye there.
I chose
different books depending on the course.
Okay. Well, let's hear an excerpt from your book, Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging. Because I felt that the section, the little paragraph I asked you to read, it gives you a little summary of your book, actually.
Thank you. Okay, so this chapter, the first chapter is called Crafting Spaces for the Reader, the Geopoetics of Discursive Mediation. The epigraph I use for that is from the book Poetics of Space from Gaston Bachelard, which says the play between the exterior and intimacy is not a balanced one. Our soul is our abode. So my chapter begins, the fact that Toni Morrison's very first novel, The Bluest Eye, begins with an epigraph from an elementary school primer is significant. In many respects, beginning her first work of fiction in 1970 with an excerpt from a text used to teach children to read is Morrison's earliest strategy for introducing her readers to what would be a lifelong concern with the art of writing and the act of reading. When we consider all the ways her work has been the subject of book bans and other forms of censorship, her early attention to the act of reading and to its potential to be racialized and politicized, was prophetic. Put another way, the novel is an introduction to what Anne Chang refers to as Morrison's critique of the pedagogy of racism, and what Baldwin refers to as one of the paradoxes of education, which is that your education makes you feel compelled to change the society in which you find yourself, in the sense that those early primers were also an introduction to American cultural values and ideas about race. It could be argued that Morrison's first novel is an intervention at the very site that contributes to the acculturation and subsequent psychic unraveling that happens to the protagonist of The Bluest Eye. In fact, one way of reading the novel, is to view it as Morrison's foray into transforming what she calls the race house by destabilizing, dislodging, and deconstructing its representation of itself.
You're listening to Marilyn Mobley reading from her book, Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging. Marilyn, in your book, and that's one of the things I like about your book, you make reference to many scholars. You know, you're building on a tradition. What is the state of African-American criticism today? And who are your peers?
I have many peers. The first one that comes to mind is Herman Beavers, who is at Penn, because he also recently did a book on Toni Morrison. And in fact, at the American Literature Association meeting, they had a Toni Morrison roundtable, and he and I talked about how our books are connected and related.
Right.
There are other scholars.
His book is called Geography and the Political Imaginary in the Novel of Toni Morrison.
Thank you. Yes. A good brother scholar friend of mine. I would also say Dana Williams at Howard, who's got a new book coming out next year on Toni Morrison as an editor. I would say Farrah Griffin at Columbia University. Even though Farrah doesn't just do literature, she also does jazz and popular culture and so on, but she is a scholar whose work I would say is important, who's still doing African-American literary scholarship. I also would say Angeline Mitchell at Georgetown. So there are people around the country who are doing different kinds
but
of
you,
work.
But you say something very interesting with just those few names.
Uh-huh.
It's that I feel that with all of the African-American literature coming out, it seems that African-American women are taking the lead in criticism. You know, the same way we saw it in the 1970s, you know, what I call like the feminization of African-American literature, women were to the forefront, your Audre Lorde, your Jane Cortez, June Jordan, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison. It feels right now there's a number of men critics, but it seems that when we look at the books that people are making reference to, they're books by African-American women.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I started with Herman Beavers.
And so, I know.
I don't want to leave the men out. But
right.
These are just some of the people that come to mind. And I don't want to leave people out because I was so focused on my book that I wasn't going to conferences. When you become an emeritus professor, you're not out and about in the same way.
Yeah, but you be modest. Your book is very well researched and you're very well read. Okay. I begin by looking at your bibliography and your notes.
Since you did that, you know, one of the people I still include is Henry Louis Gates. I mean, I know he's kind of migrated all around into other areas. You know, he did the book on the Black Church and all that. So there are a lot of other people, you know, that maybe they're not coming to mind right now, but maybe what you're saying is true. I think some of the men are in the arts, you know, are writing, and then some of the women are in the criticism,
right.
But I just don't want to make that distinct
of gender.
Statement.
I understand that. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, because I don't want to omit someone that I'm just not coming.
Oh, we'll just omit them today. It's our show. Okay. But let me ask you this big question, which is, I think, is very important for our listeners. Explain to our listeners what geopoetics is.
Geopoetics is the way in which Toni Morrison's use of space and places is connected to how she writes. And so I was interested in moving beyond themes. You know, a lot of people have talked about the themes in her work, and I want to look at, well, what are her narrative strategies? How does she write? How does she use space and place, which is the geo part, and then poetics? What are the narrative strategies she's using? What are the styles of writing that she's using that could help us reread her work? So I was interested in her interest in how, not the what, but how does she write? So I said there were four different kinds of geopoetics or narrative strategies that she used. And the first one is from that chapter we just read from, discursive mediation. She takes takes opposites and lets you see that culture is in between them. I love the end of The Bluest Eye, where she says, we thought we were beautiful when we stood next to people who we thought were ugly. And so she's always trying to talk about, yeah, but culture is in between those two. You have these polar opposites of beauty and ugliness, but there's something else in between, and she's focused on that. So that's discursive mediation as a strategy. Then I think she's interested in what I call emancipatory. I want to be sure I use emancipatory spaces. And that is where she's looking at how the interior is a space that often is not discussed, what people are feeling and thinking. And a lot of the, since you mentioned male and female, a lot of the Black male writers, there was so much attention on the exterior world, on racism and what racism looked like and how it operated. And Morrison was aware of that. She says at one point, however, the racism is a distraction. And so I think one of her geopoetics was, okay, let's get around that distraction. What's our interior life like? What do we think about?
Wouldn't that be where you would look at the difference between, say, Richard Wright and James Baldwin, that Baldwin looks at the interior life?
I would say Baldwin does too. Mm-hmm. And I think that may be why Baldwin and Toni Morrison were such good friends. Mm-hmm. I think she was even tickled by his expression that some Black male writers wrote as if they had a little white man on their shoulder telling them how to write. And I don't think she felt that was true for James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. So James Baldwin, who I love to teach as well. In fact, the last course I taught before I retired was on James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and Ta-Nehisi Coates on race in America. But the point, I think she felt that there was a need to focus on the interiority of her characters and of Black people. The narrative rememory is the third strategy I talk about. Narrative rememory, of course, is how she structures Beloved. And that's one of the books that people say is really hard. They had to come back to it. They started, they stopped, they started, they stopped. Some people said they just didn't read it. but I think narrative rememory is a very important concept. And I love teaching Beloved. It's become my favorite book, I believe. It's hard to say. It's like loving, you love all your children. But in any event, narrative rememory was a strategy of structuring a novel the way the mind remembers. And the mind doesn't remember in a linear way. You know, I'm a minister who I do grief ministry, and I try to help people understand Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was fine, but we don't grieve in stages. Death and dying may happen in stages, but we don't grieve in stages. It's very circular. It goes all around. And so Morrison structured Beloved the way the mind remembers. We can be looking at each other right now and thinking about last night, yesterday, or 5 years ago. And so Morrison wanted to look at, when you've had a traumatic experience like her protagonist, Setha, your mind is going to take you back. It's going to haunt you. So the book is not structured in a way that people like. If you like a good beach read, whatever that is, you don't want a book that just plops you in. I talk a lot about in medias res. So that's a geopoetic strategy, to just plop a reader in the middle of nowhere and start narrating. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is interrogations of home. That's one of her strategies. She looks at home spaces and tries to get readers to think about, well, what is home? What is domestic space? Not just inside a family, but what is domestic space in the land? And then she has an essay called The Foreigner's Home, that was also based on an exhibit in Paris, The Foreigner's Home. So she's interrogating home in a variety of ways. And in an essay called Home, she said that she was trying to imagine a place where race matters and race doesn't matter.
You know, when you say that, and you made reference to that essay, I think mm-hmm. that's so important for now because we deal with issues of immigration and
yes.
home and displacement.
Yes. Thank mm-hmm. you. Yeah. That's what I mean by her vision was so prophetic as an author. But when she wrote that essay and she was doing that exhibit, she was really intrigued with how migrations take place. People migrate from place to place, and then there's this sense of where is home, and then there's the state and the force of power trying to determine who is home and where do you belong, which is why that word belonging is part of my title. So she says there will always be that kind of concern. She mentions it even in her Nobel lecture in 1993. But this idea of interrogating home, where do we belong? And when she wrote the essay Home and said she was trying to write for a change, she was really working this. She was struggling. Is there a way to be a racialized person, knowing your race, and yet write as if race doesn't matter? And she knew it was a difficult task, but her example, which she read at a conference, turned out to be, she gave us a sneak preview of the novel Paradise. And she says there must be a way to write about a woman walking down the road in the middle of the night, and for miles around, no one feels she was prey. And so she said she was trying to imagine a place that was both snug and wide open.
But you know, when you say, I'm listening to what you're saying, Marilyn Mobley, and it seems as if this shows the importance of African-American literature being international and world literature, because yes. I could look at what you were saying about home and the other or the foreigner and using this as a text, bringing together people who are Palestinian and Israelis.
Yeah.
I could see this, what you just said about women and having this as being a discussion in, say, India or Afghanistan, mm-hmm. you know, and really looking at how the literature works, African-American literature works on an international level.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because when I was at George Mason, I was at a campus that was very international. I mean, my first trip to Africa was as director of African American Studies there, but having students from all around the world, Case Western, the same thing. And when I was at George Mason, I was asked to head up something called the American Democracy Project, which was right before President Obama was nominated. It was a civic engagement project. And I went to the provost and I said, if I'm going to be your associate provost, I want to call it something else. I want to call it the Democracy Project. And I want to say that it's part of the American Democracy Project. I mean, it had funding in DC, but I said, how we name it at George Mason, I want to call it the Democracy Project, because I stressed to him, there are different iterations of democracy around the world. What this experiment we're doing in the United States is not the only one. And he went along with that. He went along with me being able to acknowledge that there was a need to talk about these ideas, democracy, from a global perspective, not just an American perspective. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You know, if Toni Morrison were still living, God rest her soul, I miss her. But I think she would say, I've already begun talking about these issues for a long time, about how we would treat those who are in our country who have citizenship elsewhere, mm-hmm. how we treat visitors, how we treat immigrants, how
the
we
issues,
treat
the issues of borders and boundaries.
Borders and boundaries. Mm-hmm. She was very much interested.
Let me ask you something that you were saying earlier, but I want to come back to. But and this is how I see yourself being making this contribution, and it's sort of linked to what I said about women critics taking the lead. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the thing about many times when we look at African-American literature, we think of themes, okay? And to me, when I think of that, I think of Arthur P. Davis. I think it's really brown. They're looking at theme. And but it also carried over even to Donald Bogle, you know, looking at African-American film. Like, okay, yeah. Here's a Black person that's on the screen.
Right.
What else? What's happening in terms of cinematography in that second? But it's a Black guy on the screen. I'm really happy because it's Sidney Poitier or Harry Belafonte.
Right.
But what happens is that you've moved this discussion where we're looking at, okay, what makes this go? We know there's a Black involvement, but let's take it apart and see how it's put together. And this is where I remember when people were talking about structuralism and things of that sort coming into African-American criticism, and it just changed it because it was a resistance.
Yes.
At one time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where are you in the midst of all of this?
I believe it's really important to get beneath even just praising it. You know, I used to tell my students when I would go to the theater to see a Spike Lee movie, how excited I was. Oh, Spike Lee, Black people on the screen.
Right.
But beyond that, how does he do what he does? Well, he had certain cinematography strategies that he used to help us, you know, appreciate.
Yeah, I still can't deal with those dollies moving the people along.
Oh, I know. No, that was funny, right? People moving across the screen.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that in another show.
But this idea, I mean, and I don't want to get too far away right. from Toni Morrison, but this idea, I used to say, when the movie he made of Malcolm X came out, I remember fussing about the movie. So I said, yes, when I first went, I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But I kept thinking, why didn't he show more of what Malcolm read in prison? You know, my attitude is he's the guy who can do the dolly sliding across the screen. So I didn't like it when people said to me, well, you know, he only has so much time in a movie. I said, no, no, no. I said, Malcolm read some of everything while he was in prison. Don't just show me a dictionary.
Madeline Mowley, let's go from Malcolm back to Morrison.
Fine.
Okay. And I want to ask, before I take a little break of Madeline Mowley, I want to ask you a question, which I think is important when we look at Toni Morrison. How does Morrison's skills and background as an editor influence how she writes and thinks about literature?
Well, I love that question because she was at Random House. I like for people to know that she worked at Random House for several years, is the reason we have the biography, the autobiography of Angela Davis, is the reason we had the work of Muhammad Ali, the work of John McCluskey even. And so I would say the fact that she was an editor made her attentive to every word, attentive to every sentence. I went to Princeton to look at the archives, and you just see how she labored over language. She labored over narrative, how to tell the story. She didn't want to tell it the way it had been told before. She was always interested. And I would say that her work as an editor made her attentive to language in ways that maybe some authors are not.
Now let me ask you this. Maybe you might be the person that can answer this question.
Uh-oh.
Toni Morrison edited Henry Dumas's work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering to what extent she was influenced by Henry Dumas's work.
Oh, well, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure to what extent she was influenced by his work.
Well, I'll give you an example. When I got a copy of Black Fire, you know, Larry Neal and Mary Baraka.
Larry Neal's book, uh-huh.
Right. That short story, Fun, by Henry Dumas, like, was like, I didn't see anything, I hadn't read anything like that. You know, it was just magical, you know. And when I see, like, something like Song of Solomon, it seems as if, you know, many times we may not say it, you know, but people have a tendency of borrowing and sampling. And I was just wondering, you know, what she saw something, because Henry Dumas' work was just really, it was like listening to Sun Ra albums, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, actually, Henry Dumas wrote some of the liner notes for the Sun Ra album. So you can see where I'm going with this, because I remember.
Well, I think that's a very good question. I don't know whether I can say I recall a direct influence. So I don't want to make a claim that I can't support, but I do believe there is that real thing called anxiety of influence. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that reading and editing certain people can influence your writing. Mm-hmm. And so I believe the influences are probably there. I'm glad you mentioned Henry Dumas, as opposed to people love to say Faulkner and Virginia
right,
Woolf.
Right, right.
But that's only because, you know, she did do her master's degree mm-hmm. on those two writers. And, you know, so if you look long enough, you may see influence of them as well, you know.
Right.
But
as well as another person that she edited, Toni K. Bambara.
Toni K. Bambara, that's right. That's right. So I believe there may be influences. I can't say that that was the focus of my work, that I could pick them out. But I think it's a valid statement that people that she read and people that she edited Probably did influence her writing.
Right. And I'll go back because you made a passing reference. You made reference to Claudia Tate. And I remember Claudia Tate, who was doing all these interviews, you know, with African-American women writers. You're saying, mm-hmm. Ethelbert, you know, you can interview a person, but you can't say that, take everything that they say as being the truth. Okay.
Ah.
You know,
I'm telling the truth today, though.
Right. Just like I asked this question about Dumas to Eugene Redmond, because Redmond did a lot of work with Emmy Dumas. And I said, same question I asked you. And his response was, well, you know, she used to make reference to Henry Dumas until after the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
And then I guess you stand on your own. But anyway, we're going to take a little break, okay?
Okay.
My guest this morning is Marilyn Mobley. She's the author of Toni Morrison, The Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging, published by Temple University Press. The show's On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
On Sunday, October 6th, 9 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. Our beloved Sunday programmers will explore the rich musical palette of Latinx artists, from the strings of Villa Lobos to Salsera Graciela, to the Cuban jazz and electronic sounds of Omar Sosa. That De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Marilyn Mobley, author of Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging. In your book, Marilyn, you highlight Morrison's 1988 lecture, Unspeakable Things Unspoken, The Afro-American Presence in American Literature. Talk about this essay, which we can find in The Source of Self-Regard. What did you find that's important in this essay?
Several things. One, it's an Unspeakable Things Unspoken that she became a literary critic in front of us because she took the first lines of her novels and kind of dissected them. And I thought, oh my, she's stepping into our territory. Well, of course, it's not fair to say that because she was an editor, she was an author, and she also was a professor. So she taught creative writing. And I think she was interested in all the ways that our literature has layers, Black literature has layers, and we've had a presence in literature even when it has been devalued, that we've been in other people's literature even when they've devalued it. So I think it was an essay where she wanted to talk about her own learning and her own teaching about African-American literature. And looking at how each of her novels, the first line of each of her novels, tells more about the culture than my first meet the eye, you know. So I often, in my book, am questioning calling Quiet as It's Kept the first line of The Bluest Eye, for example. Mm-hmm. But she does talk about what Quiet as It's Kept means and how you can look at the African-American presence in literature by looking at how that language talks about culture and secrecy and how people are communicating on multiple levels when they say one thing, but it really is vernacular. You know, it's Black vernacular that is expressing what a larger culture might not know. The larger culture might not know when you say quiet as it's kept, it's not kept quiet.
Okay.
And so I think in that essay, she was really trying to say she has given a great deal of thought to even the first line of her novels. This gets back to her being an editor, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's an essay that illustrates she's both an editor and author, not both, an editor and author and a critic, and is able to look critically at the scope of Black literature beyond her own work.
Okay. I want to go back to something that you were talking about. I want to go back to it because it underlines, you know, the title of your book. Mm-hmm. So talk about the complex third space for being and belonging in Morrison's novel.
So an example of the third space, maybe I'll go to Beloved, where the character is dealing with being haunted by the death of the child she killed. And the mother is Setha, and her daughter is being entertained by the ghost, and the daughter wants the ghost to come back. And in the middle of, I think, ironing, she says, "Oh, there it is again." And so even though she's there present with her daughter, her mind, her interior space, her mind goes back to what it was like to be sexually assaulted, to get the words on the tombstone. Her mind goes back to everything that had happened to her during enslavement. And so that's kind of an interior space. In real time, it's a mother-daughter exchange. But Morrison is interested in how in real time, even though they're right there together, her mind is in another place altogether, where her life was totally different, where everything changed for her. I've talked about it in other places before, where she had to make what some people say was an ethical decision. I say she made a decision out of love. I was thinking about the novel Sula, where you have two friends, their lives go in divergent ways. One does a very traditional life and the other does a different, you know, she goes away to college and comes back, sleeps with her best friends. Man, I mean, it's kind of an interesting story, right? But we get the interior life of the friend who is, who's mistreated, we'll say it like that. We get the interior life. She realizes near the end, all the time, I really value this friendship. I was stuck on exterior things, but the me of me was interested in something else. We even get the interior life when we get to the novel Jazz, where the male character in Jazz, I just drew a blank on his name. Goodness, it'll come back to me. But the husband in Jazz, we get his interior life. You know, he's in the present, but he's really thinking about the South. What was it like being down South, and how being up North is a new sense of freedom? The character Frank Money in the novel Home has the same thing. He's traveling, trying to get to his sister, but all the while, his interior life is about this haunting of what was it like being in the Korean War? Why did he not want to go South? He's only south to help his sister. But we get his interior life, meaning the different layers of the past that are in his memory.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I wanted to go back to, we were talking about the theme of home in Farner, because she's also writing about how home is only memory.
Right. Right. It very much is memory. And to use that expression she used in the essay Home, it's a place that's snug and wide open. The place that really is home, the place where you feel at home, is that it's a place that's snug and wide open. You feel like you belong and you feel free to experience your full potential. Any place that doesn't have both of those two together for her cannot be home.
Right. You write in your book that Toni Morrison has been a friend of our mind and we are better for it. What did you mean by that?
Well, she's definitely been a friend of my mind. but the character Paul D is the one who says that in Beloved. And he says, I mean, it became the last video documentary about Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. And what Paul D meant when he said that about Setha is, he said, the pieces I am, she puts them all together and puts them in some sort of order. And therefore, there's nothing like a woman who's a friend of your mind. For me, it's been so wonderful over these years of reading and studying Toni Morrison to see a writer who could talk about my hometown, Akron, my home state, Ohio, and move beyond just, you know, little niceties to deeper levels, who could talk about Black people, not just as racialized people, but as thinking people, as loving people, as people who have had a life beyond what white people have done to us, however we envision that or understand that. And so I think she was always interested in how can we unapologetically get beyond the gaze and think about what is the caliber of our lives? What is the quality of our lives? And how are we part of the greater humanity that being alive is. So a writer who can do that for me is my kind of writer. I mean, if you only put me in the black box and don't understand how rich the black box is, and don't understand that I'm also connected to and have much in common with people who are not in the black box. Morrison was able to do that. I mean, when she gave her Nobel lecture, she was on a global stage talking about how narrative works, how our stories work. So she's been a friend of my mind because she could speak to the different pieces that I am and the different pieces that I know my people are, the different pieces that women are. I just feel like there's a way she touched humanity and the different aspects of it that always made these interviews she did so funny to me. There were people who interviewed her and they would say things, they would say racist things to her, like, well, when are you going to write about white people? And she said, I have written about white people. They're in my book. But if you come with a bias about who she is and what she's writing about, you'll miss how she was saying there's nothing lesser about the subject she has chosen unless you come with that bias already that it is lesser. So she's been a friend of my mind because she's helped me teach students about the humanities. She's helped me teach students about language and narrative. I love the line.
I'm glad you said that, because I want to go back to a question I asked you about Toni Morrison being a difficult writer. You mentioned on around, I think, page 174, 175, you write about Morrison constructing texts that frustrate the reader with an unreliable narrator or meandering narratives to challenge the reader to follow the story. So talk about this whole thing, like the unreliable narrator, which is one, and then the meandering narratives.
Both happen.
Sounds like Charlie Parker or something like that in there.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. So it's partly in jazz. You know, the character, the narrator is talking, and then the narrator has the city as a character. And then at one point, the narrator says, you know, well, I don't really know anything. You think I know something. So the narrator actually starts talking to the reader directly, almost coming out of the page, talking to the reader. And then the book, in a sense, plays with the reader. At the end, the narrator says, aha, look where your hands are now. So there's that, and that same idea of the intrusive narrator kind of disrupting things is also in Home, where the narrator says, well, wait a minute, don't think you understood me just now. You don't understand me yet. So some readers are not going to like that. Other readers are going to find it hilarious, like I did. I said, there she goes again.
Okay, well, then let me mention, because this seems to be key to your research. And you talk about this very early in your book. It might be the basis of your book. Talk about how a text speaks to a reader, and how does an author invite the reader to speak to the text?
Yeah, so that's her claim, that she's inviting the reader in. And I believe it's because when she uses certain expressions, I'll go back to the one when she first talked about this idea, quiet as it's kept. Now, it could be argued, excuse me, that a phrase starts to disseminate through the culture and it's no longer unique to a particular group. But I think it's her way of saying, when you say quiet as it's kept, that's understood by a whole community. That's an idea about language and secrecy. Language and something being inside a community as a...
I hear my mother right now.
Yeah. So I think she wanted to write in such a way that she wasn't always explaining every line like that. She wanted to simply say it. And in a sense, Black people would go, oh yeah, quiet as it's kept. That means somebody told something. You know, so I think she was writing in such a way that certain nuances of culture and understanding could be there, and she wouldn't have to explain those.
Well, let me ask you as a teacher, how do you help a student understand that?
Well, I do some of what I just did with you. I start talking about what's underneath quiet as it's kept. And encouraging the students to share what is quiet as it's kept mean. Share what, when you hear that expression, what comes to mind. I found when I teach Toni Morrison, it's very important to encourage students to say, what's underneath what you just heard? And I think the best teaching is the teaching that allows the students to do what Toni Morrison said she was doing. Bring to the text what you heard. And I try to make the classroom a rich space for that kind of discourse, so that I'm not standing in the front of the class saying, this is the way to interpret Toni Morrison. I come to her work with, what is it that you're reading in the text? Tell me how you're experiencing the text. How is the language affecting you? Because I think there is space for all of that. I love the Nobel lecture because the Nobel lecture has what I call, it starts out with kind of a narrative cul-de-sac, because the young people challenged the lady, said, is the bird in our hands alive or dead? And over time, both discussions are in the room, what they think about her and what she thinks about them. But they say to her, make up a story. Tell us what you think. You know, tell us what life has been to you. So in a sense, that's what I do in the classroom.
She's also saying that bird is also language.
That bird is language. When she's sharing it, and she's also explaining it. The author says, in my telling of the story, the bird is language. And so that's where she wants readers to go with that whole lecture. What happens in that space where readers tell their stories to one another and challenge each other? So that's the kind of space I try to make in the classroom when I teach Morrison. We read passages aloud, just like you and I are doing, and I ask students to share. And sometimes you get a difference that's based on cultural difference. It's also based on gender. Sometimes you get differences based on class.
And you say, Ethelbert, I'm not going to give you an A. Let me ask you this. I'm going to take you back, Marilyn Mobley, to May 1993. You, when I introduced you, I mentioned that you were a founding member of the Toni Morrison Society. Mm-hmm. And I believe that was at the American Literature Association conference in Baltimore.
That's right.
And 26 scholars came together. What does the society do?
Oh, that's a
wonderful question. Is this like the Divine Nine?
There's some members of the Divine Nine.
You probably a member of the Divine Nine.
You just want me to say that I'm a Delta? Okay. So,
I knew you wouldn't get it in there.
And Toni Morrison was an AKA.
So I knew you wouldn't get that in there.
There you have it.
You see, this is what I'm talking about, how the women are controlling the criticism.
But it was a group of men and women, thank you very much,
all right,
who came together at the invitation of Carolyn Dinard. And she said, do you think it's time for a Toni Morrison Society? Which was wonderful. You know, there's one for Langston Hughes. There's one for Alice Walker. And so we said, yes, yes, yes. And so the Toni Morrison Society convenes scholars, readers of Toni Morrison. You don't have to be a scholar to be a member of the society. And when I was president, I referred to it as scholars and the community of readers, because I wanted us to be an inclusive group. At our conferences, we have scholars, we have community people, we have people who just belong to book clubs who love Toni Morrison. But we convene so that the scholarship can be shared. Until her death, she came to our biennial conferences. We started with one in Georgia, because we want to begin where Georgia State, which is where Carolyn Dinard was. We also were able to have her join us down to Cartersville, which is where her father was from.
Well, you guys were very, you know, visionary, because you organized this 5 months before she received the Nobel Prize.
Exactly. We take great pride in that, I must tell you. Thank you for acknowledging that. So we had that meeting in May. She didn't get the Nobel till December. And so we were pleased that we had that foresight to go ahead and form this organization. We meet around the country, now around the world. We did a biennial conference in Paris, and it was in Paris where they told us, they said, she's a rock star here. She brought Black youth who had not been in the Louvre before to the Louvre. So it's just been a wonderful ride. When she turned 70, I was president. Rita Dove and Walter Mosley were our MCs. And we hosted a birthday party for her, a birthday tribute. I want to say celebration to for her.
There must have been dancing and stuff there too with Rita Dove.
At the New York Public Library.
There must have been some dancing.
Yeah, well, Rita danced, but Amiri Baraka danced with Tony. I will never forget that. He twirled her around on the dance floor.
Okay, we're going to mention that Baraka is no longer here with us, but Monday would be his 90th birthday.
Oh, wow.
And so we want to remember him. But let me back to, before we move towards the end of our show, Marilyn Mobley. Two things. One, when we look at these societies, when we look at some of these conferences, and I'm thinking of writers like Ellison and Richard Wright, it seems sometimes the scholars are looking at the same thing over and over again. Okay. And I was wondering, when we look at the Toni Morrison Society and various conferences, are there things, themes, books that we're really to be examining more closely, but we're focusing on, say, Song of Solomon, Beloved, and The Bluest Eye?
No, I would say writers are trying to go back to her work and look at different dimensions of her work. You know, actually, Tia Miles did an essay in the book. She did a book. There was a book of religious essays about Toni Morrison, and Tia Miles did something there. So I think scholars are trying to find new approaches to her work, not just go over the same ground over and over again. Her last book, God Help the Child, it may take you back a little bit to The Bluest Eye and the focus on colorism and how colorism shows up in the Black community. But even near the end of her life, you could say, oh, some of the same themes, but she was coming at them from a different way. And
maybe to ask the question differently. Mm-hmm. Are scholars, say, overseas, whether it's Africa or West Indies or Europe, are they looking at different things, looking at Toni Morrison differently? Coming out of, like, say, Brazil or Portugal, would you see something different because of your background and your colonial experience, for example?
I think so. You know, I remember when we were in France, one of the Japanese scholars said to me he was upset that Toni Morrison didn't seem to be that interested in the criticism. She was interested in the translations. And I said, well, as someone who's focused on language, she wants to be sure you're thinking what she wrote. I said, I used the example, this is a Japanese scholar who has been part of African-American literature courses in Japan. Mm-hmm. And I said, Eruptions of Funk. I said, how do you all say that in Japanese? So he started laughing. He said, okay, I see your point. So he understood that Toni Morrison did want his perspective as a critic, but she wanted to be sure the language was right first. And I actually did, when I was in Paris, we did a meeting with scholars who teach her work from different parts of the world. And part of what they were sharing was there were expressions that they didn't understand. So they were happy to meet with us to try to understand them. But there were some themes that were similar. You know, about
let me ask you a difficult question. Not putting you on the
that spot. One was already difficult.
Okay. I'm just wondering about this because we see this in terms of sports. Does Toni Morrison's skill as a novelist decline during
does what injury?
Does her skill as a novelist decline over a period of time, like how, you know, you have an athlete's skill declines? You know, like someone says, for example, they felt that maybe Baldwin's novels near the end were not as good as, say, what he wrote earlier.
I don't want to use the word decline. Maybe I'm biased that I wouldn't say decline. I would say her novels, those last two, were shorter.
Like little novellas, pretty much.
Complex in a different way, not complex the way her longest novel was. Mm-hmm. It seemed like she got a little more terse near the end. But I think she just found less was more.
Well, when I look at it, I felt her essays became more interesting.
I think so. And I think that's why The Source of Self-Regard is so exciting to me. You know, so many of her essays. She did a lot of commentary, quiet as it's kept. A lot of commentary, a lot of interviews. Sometimes I used to jokingly say, Toni Morrison gives a speech, bam, it's a book. you know, that's Playing in the Dark was like that. The Dancing Mind was like that. These were speeches that became books. But I think she was very interested in our culture, very interested even in politics. And so I think that maybe that critical voice started to take over more near the end. Because I noticed it. I mean, a lot of us noticed it, that those last books were just shorter.
Right.
I don't know. You know, it's difficult to say what was happening. Or
yeah, I always wonder about whether that's an indication of the publishing industry getting involved. You know, the marketing, the making the money off a particular author, especially an author that's well known, that you mm-hmm. you could send in anything that might be unfinished. You know, we didn't talk about some of her other, you know, plays, things of that sort, you know, big in terms of her skills. But is there anything that you would like to say in closing about Toni Morrison, Marilyn?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I teach Beloved, you know, I used to say my students sometimes would try to play me because they would be referring to the film. And I would go, no. That was the movie. But she also wrote a libretto, Margaret.
Right.
And we saw it performed down in Cincinnati. And I'll never forget that trip because our late sister Bernice Johnson Reagan was with us. Mm-hmm. And so I think that she was prolific in other ways. She wrote a play, Dreaming Emmett, about Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. But that Margaret, the reason I mentioned Margaret is it shows it started as a novel. That was Oprah Winfrey. That was not Tony's idea that it'd be a movie, but anyway, it was a film. And then she wrote the libretto with Daniel Richard Poor, yeah. Which is it's called Margaret. Mm. So that was important to me. And I also think it's important that people go back and read Recitative, which was her only short story.
Right.
It's just a powerful short story because I actually did a TED talk about it, because she throws the reader back on herself, mm-hmm. themselves. She throws readers back on themselves, because you're left trying to figure out which girl in that story is Black and which girl is white. And Morrison's point, well, why do you care? Why does
you
know, it matter?
When you say that, I recall a program that was proposed, but actually never, I think got canceled, but it was supposed to be a conversation between Bill Clinton and Toni Morrison, you know, when everybody was talking about Bill Clinton being the first Black president, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know, so I thought they would really be interesting in terms of issues of race and color. Very interesting to see what Toni Morrison would say to Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Well, anyway. I would like to hear what she's saying right now. She's up in heaven talking right now about the
upcoming
situation,
election.
The situation we're in now. but I appreciate this opportunity to talk about her. I've always been interested in this idea, this space between race matters and race doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think that prompted me to write the book, because she wants us to see how both things can be true.
Well, and you've done a wonderful job in terms of her memory and keeping her work and helping us understand her better. So I want to thank you, Marilyn Mobley. My guest today has been Marilyn Mobley. She's the author of Toni Morrison and the Geopoetics of Place, Race, and Belonging, a book that is published by Temple University Press. She's also a founding member of the Toni Morrison Society. Okay, so my name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This Saturday, October the 5th, there will be a national summit on gun violence and racism in person at the Metropolitan AME Church, 1518 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., and online at forsummit.org. The summit is a unique, solution-driven gathering of activists from D.C. and across the country, sharing policies and strategies successful in reducing violence and saving lives. The event is sponsored by the Fellowship of the Reconciliation under the leadership of Reverend Hagler with many others. Registration is at forsummit.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
The Institute for Policy Studies, Busboys and Poets, and the Nation invite you to a conversation between author and activist Bill Fletcher Jr. and labor historian Dana Frank, discussing Frank's new book, What Lessons We Can Learn from the Great Depression, Stories of Ordinary People and Collective Action in Hard Times, on Tuesday, October 8th at 6:30 p.m. Professor Frank explores how ordinary people working collectively met the crisis head on and how we can apply those lessons in the challenges we face today. The book event, What Can We Learn from the Great Depression? Stories of Ordinary People and Collective Action in Hard Times, Tuesday, October 8th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the 5th and K Street Bus Boys and Poets. For more information and a way to RSVP is online. ips-dc.org/greatdepressionlessons. That's ips-dc.org/greatdepressionlessons. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one